This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing, and in this case, the history of publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. I'm talking to Doug Messerly. He's an editor and publisher and writer of many different kinds of things, but we're going to talk today about his publishing work. Hi, Doug. How are you?
How are you?
It's good to be able to talk to you.
And it's good to be able to talk to you again, David.
Well, we've known each other a very long time.
Indeed.
So we're going to...
I don't remember what year, but...
Me neither, but...
It's been decades.
It is. I think it's coming up on 40 years.
Yeah.
What I'd love to have you do is talk about the history of your involvement in publishing, as well as literature in general and and writing and how it all fits together. And as I recall, your first publishing was Labà. Am I right about that?
No.
Okay.
Actually, you aren't. I rechecked it just to make sure too.
Okay. Well, then you should tell me, what was your first involvement in literary publishing?
Actually, it was the magazine Sun and Moon, a journal of literature and art. And, it began in probably about 1974. On my birthday, May 30th, 1974, I suddenly told Howard, my companion for 45 years now, and we're married last year.
Congratulations on that, of course.
I just told him, I said, I want to begin a magazine. I had been toying with it in my mind. I was in graduate school by that time, and had studied with my mentor of the period, Marjorie Perloff, and she was the one who'd really introduced me to poetry and exciting poetry, and it changed my whole perspective. I won't go through my whole literary background, but actually my first love was theater, and I was very involved in theater as a child, reading Albee and Pinter and everybody when I was a teenager, all the major Ionesco, everybody. And then I grew interested in fiction, but for most of my undergraduate and my MA degree, worked in fiction, doing work on actually very odd thing when you know what my perspective is these days, but on Southern literature. Faulkner and Welty and Eudora Welty and others. But Marjorie Perloff really generated a kind of exciting new perspective that you would now call in the old days postmodern. And I changed my whole way of perceiving about literature, not disliking anything I liked before, but including a lot of things I didn't perceive before. And as I began writing my own poetry, I decided I needed to start a journal of literature and art. You know, many people think that and imagine that they could do one. And I had enough hubris to imagine I could, and decided I would do a magazine. Now, understand, I had no real literary knowledge of the field in that period of time and no real understanding of what it entailed to do a magazine. So at first, I conceived that Sun and Moon would be a kind of mimeograph or Xerox magazine. And that's what I sort of said to Howard, let's do, because we could afford it. We had no money. We were graduate students, both of us. And Howard at that time was in literature, later on to become an art curator. But in those periods, he was in literature too. But already he had begun through American Studies working in art, and then had gotten a job as a curator at the Hirshhorn Museum. And so we wanted it to be a journal of literature and art, which was very highfalutin in our minds. And it was sort of based, in my perception, on Art and Literature by John Ashbery, the great magazine. And by this time, I had already begun studying the history of a lot of small presses. So I did know a little bit, and I knew a lot of the presses out of the 60s, especially after taking Marjorie's course. I knew O'Hara and the whole New York school and the tradition of small magazines and all the magazines that John Wieners had been involved with and Amari Baraka and many, many others. So I had a sort of history, and I sort of conceived that I wanted something like Art and Literature. So I'll stop there for a moment. For breath.
Well, that gives me a chance to ask her. And that you sort of hit on something that is interesting, and that is the milieu, the historical milieu of the immediate, say, 20 years prior to when you started.
Yeah.
This was 1975, right?
Right, correct. The magazine started in 1975, yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, in those days, I think we saw as antecedents, as you said, all of these, you know, the kind of mimeo underground magazine and small publishing that was going on through the 50s and 60s, where the Beats and the Black Mountain poets and the New York School poets had to publish themselves because that was their only outlet. They were excluded from, either on purpose or by, you know, kind of aesthetically, from the mainstream magazines.
And it was also very much the aesthetics, too. The typewriter was king, and you could do this very cheaply and create all sorts of different kinds of magazines that represented smaller visions or larger visions, whatever you wanted. But remember, the model was Art and Literature, which was very glossy, very beautiful, and a stunningly handsome magazine. So there were two parts of me, I guess. One, I wouldn't have minded a glossy magazine. We just had no money. And so therefore I had to think about it in terms of a mimeograph, or probably in those days, the Xeroxing was good enough. People forget that there was a period of time when there was no Xerox either in my own history. And so you were sort of in between. You really couldn't, it was too expensive. You still had letter type. You know, you had to get it, the hot type. And so it was almost impossible. It was way outrageous, beautiful, but outrageously expensive to do. And so, for me, the only alternative became that. But then something happened that made me have to change my mind. I sent out blindly to a wide range of poets and fiction writers. I wanted it to be including fiction, poetry, belles-lettres, and art. I never, ever got to the point where I just wanted it to be a poetry magazine or a fiction magazine or something like that. I wanted it to be rather eclectic. But I didn't quite understand that I didn't want it to be as eclectic as it began, because I wrote to a wide range of people, like Leonard Michaels. I don't know if anybody remembers Leonard Michaels, but he was published by Farrar Straus in those days. Marge Piercy, a whole bunch of different people. And then I also wrote to Gil Sorrentino and to a lot of more experimental or, you know, innovative writers who I would later be more interested in. But they all sent me work. And this was the shocking thing. And once I started getting these manuscripts that were just really very wonderful, I thought I was very excited. And of course, a lot more than that for me at that period of time, because I didn't have a deep understanding of where I was going to go or what my literary tastes were. It was just names, and they were some big names. And so I talked it over with Howard. I said, well, I've got Gilbert Sorrentino sending me work. You know, what am I going to do? So Howard's father funded the first two issues of the magazine. And we created a very luxurious magazine that actually looked, in some respects, like Art and Literature. It had the same kind of carrying of the names across in bands. And we called it, the reason I called it Sun and Moon was obviously like Art and Literature, you know, two different bodies of work, the literature and art moving together. And Marjorie Perloff insisted that I use the semicolon instead of calling Sun and Moon. So we used semicolon because it was more arresting sort of as its title. The only problem with the Sun and Moon actually came from an Austrian novel called Sonne und Mond by a wonderful Austrian writer who was influenced very much by a writer I later published, Anita von Dorderer. And I just thought that was a heavy-sounding, remarkable-sounding thing. But very quickly, I realized I made a mistake, because there was Sung Young Moon, all about the world, the Korean, if people remember, right, who married masses of people and had followers and all those things. And so for years, I suffered from that. Even after I became a publishing house, I would always get put over by, you know, either the Korean video group or something when I went to the big conventions, the publishers conventions. And it was terrible, you know, when I was still doing my own distribution and distributing other people's houses. I was always outcast and really strange because people didn't know what I was in some kind of way. Those that did obviously knew what I stood for, but overall, it sounded kind of new age, hippie, and slightly cultish. And I never wanted it to be that way. It was, to me, these were serious, forces, planetary forces, in fact. But I guess by about the third issue, this really broad eclecticism began to channel just a little bit. And I began to find out what I was really trying to. But even in the third issue, I have Juna Barnes and then Clark Coolidge, and then I have, really unknowns. I mean, and in literature, I mean, in art, we had Robert Longo and all sorts of major figures right from the beginning. So it was a sort of odd mix in a strange way. We didn't really quite know. Howard knew more where he was going than I knew where I was going in literature. Let me put it that way.
And did you see the magazine as I suspect, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did you see it as an extension of your and Howard's kind of literary and artistic views? I mean, it's part, it was part of you being a writer for you was also being an editor and it engaged you with it allowed you to engage directly with writers that you were interested in.
It did eventually, but it didn't at first. At first, I was a real dilettante, and I really didn't understand. That's why I had such a strange mix. We have just on the front cover, for instance, on number three, there's Bruce Renner, who nobody knows today. He's a sort of modernist, late modernist. He's still living, I think, in Milwaukee poet. We had Rochelle Ratner, mm-hmm. Freya Manfred, mm-hmm. Maria Gittin. But then we had King and Jimmy and Clark Coolidge, as I said, Guy Bining, who I still think is a very interesting poet, by the way, Juna Barnes. It was a wide range of things. We also had in that same age Chana Horowitz, who I think just died last year and was a remarkable artist who I still admire very much. We had Joseph Shannon, who's a very wonderful artist from Washington, D.C., he was in that. And then people who nobody heard of and who I probably would never have published in a few years later. But by number four already, we already had Barbara Guest, Charles Henry Ford, Charles North, Larry Eigner, Gerard Malanga, that's an odd one there, I guess, Lucy Lippard, Douglas Wolfe, Michael Lally, Tom Ahern, Tom Clark. It was a different kind of magazine suddenly, Ted Greenwald. Ray De Palma. I mean, it goes on. So by the fourth issue, I had really begun to define myself, although it still has a lot of figures who today I probably wouldn't publish. So it didn't right in the beginning define my own aesthetic, which I was still developing, by the way, too. So, I mean, I didn't quite know where I was. Soon thereafter, I began to really be involved in a different kind of way because I began to also publish some books. And when I began publishing books at the same time, then my whole perspective changed.
So now, when did you start publishing books? What year?
I don't remember the exact year, but it must have been, I do know what year it must have been. Maybe 76 or 77 already. So what happened very quickly? And we'll go back to Labah, which was your first question. What happened very quickly is that I realized after the first two issues were paid for that I could get grants. This was the period of time that there was beginning to be CCLM money, which is the Coordinating Council of Literary Magazines, and eventually NEA money. And so there were two sources, which is unheard of today, for presses and for magazines. Magazines in those days could also apply for NEA grants. And so there were two sources, but I had to wait around because I did try to do two issues a year. I couldn't do that ultimately, but I had to wait around in order to be able to get enough money to do the next issue. And I'm an impatient person. Once I get excited about things and start doing them, I get riled up and I get impatient. And I began to perceive quite early that maybe if I did some books, I could also bring in a little bit more money, because magazines, there's no hope that you're ever going to make enough money on subscriptions in running a literary magazine to survive. And at the same time, I also felt, well, there's so much good literature out there. People want to be published. Why not begin a real Mimeo magazine at the same time? And so already in 1976, I began La Ba. So I didn't realize I started that early. While I was doing Sun and Moon Press, I also, at the University of Maryland, began secretly behind their backs doing mimeographs, using the paper from the office and doing a mimeograph magazine, which I did. I did maybe about 100 issues of each one and mailed them out free to select group of poets and writers who I wanted to read the magazine. And that was a very different, very much more immediate kind of magazine that had other people who I wouldn't have included in Sun and Moon and never did appear in Sun and Moon, like Michael McClure. And again, very many pieces by Larry Eigner appeared in La Ba, etc. And there I used collage, my own art, and many other kinds of things that I wasn't able to do in Sun and Moon, because Sun and Moon already had established itself, the journal had already established itself as a kind of glossy, slick magazine. So it was, I was doing both things at the same time.
Right. I remember receiving La Ba, because I think it must have come in the mail, whereas Sun and Moon you could actually find in bookstores.
In literary bookstores, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. So I did this. The first issue of Sun and Moon came out on Valentine's Day, actually, in 1975. And again, a year later, I was already beginning La Ba, and did that till 78, which by that time I was already beginning. I can tell you exactly when I began the press, because the first book we did was a Xeroxed, side-stapled book. And it was done in 1978. That was the first book by Charles Bernstein, Shade. Mm. So you can see the press already defined itself right from the beginning for my values and tastes that would later, whereas the magazine was all over the place. It had no real defining until the last issue. It had no defining issue per se, except maybe in the art. The art was always interesting and I think diverse.
And so how many issues of Sun and Moon did you publish?
We did, let me see. I think the last issue I've got here was 1980. Its number issues 9 and 10. No, 11. So it was 1981 was the last issue. So we continued that for quite a while.
And La Ba, but La Ba ended much earlier.
In 78, so. Yeah. La Ba was it was also, I think, about 11, 12 issues, because it came out whenever I could, you know, get the energy and time to do another mimeograph magazine. And we had manuscripts coming in all the time. I had manuscripts. If I say we once in a while, it's because I always maintained a kind of corporate notion of just as a bluff to talking about the press as we. It was always me, but I thought about it as we. The actual Sun and Moon publishers actually did later have a staff, and there was a we. But for many years, it was just me doing everything, but I had a we projected, a kind of royal we.
Well, the Sun and the Moon part, the two
exactly.
Of you.
Yes, exactly.
And the books, I think, really defined Sun and Moon as the press defined Sun and Moon, you know, literarily. And maybe that's really the more, I don't want to say the more significant impact, but since the books are continued and have continued, maybe that is more, you know, your interest in the end is to be a book publisher.
I think when I began publishing books, I realized, all right, now I found my real defining nature. I can still be fairly eclectic, because we did, I think Sun and Moon did a total of 300 and some books, and Green Integers already done, my second press, Green Integer, has already done 250 books. So that's a lot of books to have published in a lifetime. I don't think any editor in commercial publishing has done that much individual publishing, you know. I mean, and I was the one who did them all. I mean, yes, I had staff, I have typesetters, and I've had wonderful, wonderful senior editors and assistants throughout the years. I've been very fortunate for no pay or very little pay. I've been able to have some of the most brilliant staff that you could imagine. But by and large, it's a pretty singular effort.
Yeah. Well, tell me, so since you brought up Green Integer, when did Green Integer come about? And I really am interested in what was the genesis of Green Integer for you?
Oh, there were two things going on there. What can I describe? Sun and Moon, because we did so much publishing, and it was rather vast, and we did a lot of contemporary publishing of contemporary writers, many of whom, and other writers, you know, we first published Juna Barnes, which became very attended, Russell Banks, who we made him sort of famous before his big book, and we did enormous amounts of other writers who later on went, you know, became very major, major figures. But we also did an enormous amount of first-time writers, international translations, which became more and more defining as I moved on to Sun and Moon. And after a while, your press grows so large, it's almost because you've got to pay for storage, you've got to have everything else going along with that, it almost became an impossible task. And then we had a sort of problem. I had an assistant who had some health problems, and that became an issue because I didn't know that I had to have certain kinds of insurance. It became an issue at the same time where the press was just growing out of proportion. And I had already begun, because again, I'm impatient and like to do other things, publishing a few books on the side in this little format of six and a fourth by six and a fourth by four, whatever it is, postcard size books, but quite thick. And you know, you could get a lot of pages within that size. And I'd done those books very differently than I did from Sun and Moon. And I did this about 2000. So at around, or 1999 is actually when I began Green Integer as a sort of offshoot, my own imprint. And it was about the same time I decided maybe I should cut back on Sun and Moon, and I finally closed down Sun and Moon in 2000 and took up Green Integer as my own imprint and my own press. And also, there were other issues going along with that, which are very complex and probably over a longer period of time we could discuss, but having to do with what nonprofits were and the responsibilities of nonprofit, and my growing a bit tired with that whole entity in some ways, and I wanted to move to a different kind of publishing, venue where I could sort of focus on international publishing and the classics that Sun and Moon had already begun. I wanted to sort of move in that direction. Sun and Moon had been so devoted to so many contemporary American writers, which I was very proud of and something I loved, but I couldn't move in that direction in Sun and Moon any longer. It wasn't an alternative, whereas I could if I began a new press. And so that's the way, the direction I moved.
So it was sort of a combination of
many things.
But one theme is artistic and another theme is practical.
Yes. Yes, it was both. It was a sense that as beautiful, as much as I loved Sun and Moon, there needed to be a kind of closure to it. In order for me to continue, I didn't want to stop publishing ever. I loved, and I probably will drop dead before I stop publishing entirely, although Green Integer is publishing far fewer titles than it used to do. But I just couldn't move in the directions I wanted to move as easily with that huge body of works following me about as Sun and Moon had, and there had to be a new different kind of direction. And I also I began to change my perception about what I really wanted to focus on. I think it had to do with aging. It had to do with the perspective of having gone through so much publishing, and also a feeling that I couldn't be the press for every young writer anymore. It just wasn't possible. There's a point when you have to, particularly after I'd done a huge anthology, or two huge anthologies, my New American Poetry anthology and my drama anthology, that really defined a generation or several decades, so to speak. I really couldn't answer the next generation or the next generation. I think you have to pace yourself, and you have to sort of look into yourself and say, can I continue to do this forever? And you have to, you know, anybody wise begins to say, no, you can't go on forever. You have to begin focusing on now what you've achieved and what you're most interested in doing. And to me, that became a kind of international publishing. And also, I just grew more and more and more interested in translation and international publishing, partly because nobody else was doing it.
Right. So does that mean, now what happened to all of the Sun and Moon books? It didn't mean they just disappeared.
No, Sun and Moon, in fact, I still have large quantities of Sun and Moon books and still offer them for sale under the Green Integer imprint. Many of them that have gone out of stock or out of print, I've put into PDF files, some for free, some for very, you know, like $5, something like that. You can order them on PDF. So I still continue to try to encourage people to read those books and to be involved with them. I offered all the authors, you know, as many copies as they wanted, and sold many other copies. I had a bookstore in those days. I had Sun and Moon developed also in remarkably beautiful. I don't know if you ever visited our offices, but it was beautiful. It was a huge, huge office, and it had its own bookstore, much like the French and almost most of the European publishers have their own bookstore. I had my own bookstore, and it was a vast space. And in that, I could sell books for lesser prices. I could have sales. And so I was able to sell off a great many of the Sun and Moon books in that manner as well.
And so now Green Integer continues. Do you have a staff for it, or are you alone?
I have one assistant who works at home. He does my typesetting and my brilliant proofreader. His name is Pablo Capra, like the film director, and his father is a film director, but they're not related. and he grew up in the United States in Malibu, and he's a surfer, but he also lived for years in Austria and knows German and is very well read. He's a young 35-year-old man who has read all of Proust and all of Musil, people like that. And yet is very interested. He has a small press himself, which publishes primarily Malibu writers and surfers. So it's very different, completely different perspective, but he's quite brilliant and quite able. And he's a marvelous typesetter, and he keeps all my websites and all of those activities. So I have one person who works for me, and then it's me, and that's it.
Right. And no more bookstore.
No, I have very nice offices, but no bookstore. I haven't had a bookstore for many, many years. In fact, Green Integer never really had a bookstore entity. I moved to upstairs offices in smaller quarters, partly because the rent on offices has grown more and more expensive as everything else has during these years, and it becomes harder and harder to sustain that.
Yeah, no, I remember going to visit. I did come and visit your kind of public space.
I had big parties there, yeah, at events, and we had a big consortium meeting there once, and whenever there was a convention in Los Angeles, I would have a big party. That was quite wonderful. Those were the days. I mean, I had the place was so marvelous. I had a bar. It had its own bar, even.
Well, it's a literary, a good literary
accoutrement. and art upon the walls and everything. It was a very distinctive location. But that was a period of time which I think is long gone now. I think it's hard for any smaller publishing house, let alone literary press, to have such a quantity. But I had it at one point. It was great.
But in a way, you were more like a literary public. I mean, in that way, by having that space, a little bit more like someplace like Beyond Baroque or, the Poetry Project being public, which is different. I mean, because you did it coming from being a press, where usually those places are public institutions, whether they started as institutions or not, they become them. And you came to it in a different path.
Well, I should just back up for a moment. I think I've seen my role always. I mean, the reason I got into publishing books and probably the magazine in the back of my mind is because I was encountering so much interesting poetry and fiction. And some of the fiction writers, like Fanny Howe, Steve Katz, and many others, had even been published at one point, and Russell Banks is another example, and Gil Sorrentino, by major literary presses. But when there was that grand shift, when major literary houses no longer could do literature that didn't quite fit into the more commercial perspective, at one time, they really attempted to have a sort of more experimental wing, almost like Grove Press kind of wing, and or New Directions kind of perspective. But that quickly disappeared. And for me, as I also remember, I was a university professor. I was a scholar as well. And it seemed like all the most interesting writers in fiction and poetry were not finding places to be published. And I don't know why I thought I could offer them that, but I thought I could. And it was almost like a sense of responsibility. I should also back up Alan Kornblum and many, many others who began presses around the same time, committed politically to publishing. We'd grown up in the 60s, and we'd been in the protests, and we saw how newspapers and journalists could have an effect, an immediate, a daily effect, on students and on interested people and in the culture at large, because we were in the Vietnam time and that we changed that in some kind of way. We made a difference. And literature and just news made that change. And for me, literature was always a force of change, but also it was a force of teaching. It was something that I loved and wanted to teach. And so I always saw myself in an educational role. And it became a natural then that, in fact, when I moved to Los Angeles, which was shortly after I'd begun publishing books, when I moved here, I started right away a salon, first in my home and then in my offices, inviting major world writers. And it wasn't just American writers. It was writers from all over. And over the years, I've had some of the major, major figures of our time reading regularly once a month in my literary salons. So that was always an activity that I had. And along with the bookstore, along with everything else, I was a very sociable person and was very involved in a larger community. And I always thought of it as an international community, too. And so I guess all of those came together finally in my later days, but they were always there. Sun and Moon had its own classics series, which primarily it was major American writers, but it was also major world writers and also writers who were no longer living. So it had everything. You know, we had André Breton. We had all the writers of the 20th century and even into the 19th century. But I felt there was a coherence and a literary fullness in it all. And I also felt that by doing that, I would also lend credence and value to my younger and contemporary writers as well.
Oh, it's very interesting to hear you talk about it this way. It's in essence, the effort to publish is about engagement And so, you know, I see what you're, you know, the way you talk about the everything you've done has been a form of engagement.
Exactly. I never really understood myself that way because I always thought of myself, well, especially in the early years of the younger days of my college days, et cetera, I thought of myself as sort of a loner, an outsider, somebody who wasn't particularly adept at social behavior. Yet, strangely enough, I became one of the most sociable people I know, and it just became a natural for me. Partly, I learned that through Howard and the art world. The art world is all about social life. And I learned that very quickly through Howard, but I also just, it was within me. And I always thought of myself as being very centered on me doing something, but I realized now that it was always working with others and always a kind of between things. In fact, one of my most recent book, which was a collaborative book with many, many poets, was called Between. And I suddenly, as I've grown older, realized that I really work best as somebody facilitating and working with others. And my own writing has a great deal to do the way I work with collage and the way I work with other writers and the way I work in my own writing in that kind of milieu is something that interrelates. It works with the interstices of things as opposed to being just, here I am, here's what I do. I never could do one thing. I was always multidimensional in how I perceive myself too. And how I put myself. It was never just fiction. It was never just literature, or poetry, or it wasn't just, and I also did a lot of film and a lot of drama, a lot of theater as well in publishing.
So, yeah, and I think maybe I'm just realizing in hearing you say that and then thinking about the fact that you write sometimes in other identities or through other identities, but I'm thinking about that. It's all that is persona and, yes. And that you know, as a publisher, yes. That's an extension of your theatrical yes. persona yes. in a way that I had literary
persona. Right. I've had literary right. persona. My designer was Katie Messborn, and it was just a made up name, made up because the very first designer I worked with was named Kevin Osborne. And it was Douglas Messerly and Kevin Osborne together, Messborn, KD Messborn. And she became my design. I designed all the books. But in fact, it was very funny when I ran into Kenny Goldsmith years and years later. Kenny said, you know, your designer is so fantastic. She's just wonderful. And I said, yes, she really is good. And he asked, now, he was going to do a website for me. And he said, now, do you think I could get permission from her to put up these images? And I said, well, of course, I'm sure she'll be happy. It'll work out just fine. And it was funny because he kept going on and on and on about this. And I don't know whether he was pulling my leg or maybe he did know it was just playing on. But at any point, I finally had to say, okay, Kenny, no, Katie Messborn's me. I'm sorry to tell you this. And of course, I've written under persona many. I mean, I write my plays all under Keir Peters. I don't hide these, but I had lots of persona. And in fact, Green Integer, the editor is Per Brenje, which means, you know, which is a Danish sort of name for Peter, you know, which is my great-grandfather's name and all sorts of other things. And Brenje is a fern, and my mother's maiden name was Farney, which means fern in Swiss. So it has all of these made-up connotations. I like that sense of play with the self because I do think all of us, more than we know, have many different personas. And we're all frightened about it because we think somehow it makes us schizophrenic or it's problematic for society. But I think it's a healthy thing. And I think to allow those different aspects of our own being to come together, sometimes you may have to hide one to do another. But I think that if you can allow all those to be together, it's a good thing. Although it does confuse people. And I think when, you know, if I were to talk about my own writing, it causes problems sometimes. People can't define you. They can't say, what is it you really do? you know, what kind of writing do you do, or what kind of publishing do you do in this case? And I do a lot of different kinds of publishing in some respects.
Right, and that does confuse people. I think people, but on, you know, on one level, as speaking as someone who's had a similar kind of messiness about my work, I sort of feel, you can defend that because it is who you are. It's an expression of your many selves. And there are people who will criticize you or for whom it's confusing or difficult. So be it. You know, there's nothing you can do about that.
No, exactly. And you can't. And in the case with my pen name for my dramas, by the time that I started going back to writing drama and writing theater, I had already established a strong poetic voice, and people knew who a Douglas Messerly poem was like, at least at that period of time. Now they're probably more confused. But I wanted to be able to have a different kind of... first of all, nobody knew me in theater, so it didn't matter that I was Douglas Messerly or Joe Blow. And second of all, I wanted to explore areas where I maybe be more conservative or more traditional and play with things. And the same thing with publishing. I also needed to feel that there was a staff, because I always wanted to project that we were professional. We were somebody out there, not just doing this amateur thing. And I resented that we were always described as a little press. You know, after I'd done Paul Auster and sold all the foreign rights of Paul Auster's three major, you know, New York trilogy books, we were described in a New York Times article as, oh, some little press that didn't even name us had done his earlier works. You know, I felt, and I wrote a letter. I was really offended because, you know, we'd done the majority of the work and made him quite famous. And I thought that was so demeaning to just suddenly be called a little press.
Well, and of course it is.
It's not that I had anything against a little press or a small press or small publishers. I admired them. That's what I cared about. But I just felt that it's so the people who are expressing those kinds of views don't have a clue of how important it is to the publishing world. And I always wanted to get around that. I wanted to get away from the notion of being some little thing over here that doesn't really matter. No, we mattered, and we did. And I think a lot of that's why I wanted to have full staffs. And I couldn't say, oh, it's me over here like the Wizard of Oz. Oh, no, it's me over here. I wanted to pretend there were other voices. Here we are. You know, we're all here.
Well, that gets to another interesting question about, you know, the role of independent literary publishers and how that has changed, you know, because when you started, as we started talking about, the antecedents were kind of, even though the work might have been beautifully produced, it was still a fleeting expression of art in most cases. Although, again, the exceptions, because the Paris Review still exists. And but
there were exceptions all along, but it was just odd. We always, Sun and Moon Press, I always used art, you know, major world writer, artists on the cover. And I still to this day get this reaction. They're beautiful, absolutely gorgeous covers. And I still get people who pick them up and say, what is this? Like it was some kind of strange thing they couldn't understand. It was a book, you know, I never comprehend what is this. But to a lot of people, it just didn't look like what they think is a novel they want to pick up or a book they want to pick up to read on an airplane or something. It was something special, and I always made it look special somehow. I couldn't not do that, and there was this strange reaction of what is this. On the other hand, I get another kind of reaction from the major publishers, because I was publishing a whole series of writers like Steve Katz and Fanny Howe and Russell Banks and Paul Auster. And this happened like in a series of about 10 or 15 writers. All of them got, our books got reviewed in those days in the New York Times. And one after another, and every time I would go to the major book conventions, the major publishers would come over and say, where do you find these writers? Like they were in some basement or something. I could go and find them, you know. And I went to look for them, and I knew where, but I wasn't going to tell them, you know. And it was so hilarious. I couldn't respond to them, actually. I just didn't know what to say. Well, you have to read, and you have to have people wanting to send you books, and you have to be willing to publish that kind of literature, you know, and that's all it's about. But they couldn't conceive that you could just find that. You know, I discovered Wendy Walker's wonderful writing because she just sent it to me one day, and my assistant, Ann Klefstad, who was a marvelous editor, said, here's a book you better look at. Same thing with Stacey Levine. She just said, here's a book you have to look at. And I did, and I loved it, and I published it. And that's the way it came to be. So it's not like they weren't available. It's just that it was the right link. You know, you just, and I didn't want agents. I didn't want to work through agents. I wanted to work directly with the writers. And they were all protected by agents and other things. They could never find these writers because they simply were not looking. Actually, Paul Ostered sent his book to every single publisher almost in the field, and all of them have rejected it. So, you know, they wouldn't have seen it even if they could.
Well,
know?
Right. It was invisible to them because
yes,
of exactly. The nature of the work. And then you can, by creating a context for it, and you gave it validity.
Exactly.
But so I guess, do you feel, maybe this again another leading question, but how do you feel about the role today of, you know, the independent publishers? Do you feel it's changed significantly over the last 30 years?
Yes,
in what way?
I do feel it has. I feel, and I almost hate to say this because I know this, it sometimes, I always said that when I grew old, I wasn't going to be somebody who sat around and said, oh, it's not like the old days, or it's not like this time, or it's not like that. But I do think there's been a major shift, and there's been some major exceptions to this as well. But by and large, I think a lot of the younger, very successful publishers, which I'm very happy that they're successful, but are doing much more commercial work than I would have ever done and been interested in, and still not interested in, frankly. I think sometimes they do a little bit interesting and outsider work, but by and large, it's very traditional. It's very commercial now. There are exceptions. Archipelago Press, Dalkey Archive is still out there doing really exciting literature to this day, although he's my age, so we're old men now at this point. But there are younger publishers who are doing this, and still Coffee House, you know, who is now under a different publisher. So there are still presses, and there are a number of them. There are even Litmus Press and a whole bunch of others that are doing exploratory and interesting work. But by and large, some of the consortium publishers now are much more traditional than any of the publishers were in my day. We were different. Some were more political in their, some were feminist, some were literary as I was, we were all doing slightly different things, but we all had a sort of different take than the regular culture. Now I think it's much more similar with the major culture. And sometimes I don't understand, except that maybe the writers aren't as well known, why are they a small press and why aren't they just a big commercial house? Although the commercial houses are even doing fewer and fewer. I mean, now it's become so different in some respects. They're doing such commercial activity that it's hard to sometimes imagine, you know, that any really interesting writer is published by a commercial press, although that still happens, strangely enough, once in a while.
No, it still does. I think what you're describing, though, is the seeding, the gradual seeding of, and that is C-E-D-I-N-G, of more and more ground that is being taken up by a nonprofit or independent publishers that exist outside of, you know, so that you end up with it's similar in some ways, maybe more than it ever was before, to the way nonprofit theater coexists with profitable.
Exactly. Theater. Exactly. It's precisely that kind of corporatization. And in fact, that's why I stopped being a nonprofit press. We can really sort of move into that right now. I got very fed up with what I saw begin to, and in fact, it happened with the grants, the larger grants that we started receiving from some of the major foundations. They wanted us to become corporate presses, hire new people, hire bigger staffs, make ourselves into something else. And then at the same time, even the NEA, every time you'd apply, you would be creating a kind of fiction. it wasn't about how much do you need to publish a book. It was based on an honest kind of construct of what it would take to do a book. But the construct is made up of all sorts of inflated budgets, because you needed to double it, first of all, and you needed to find a way that you could still do the books. And that was the real heart of the thing. So what you had to do is much of what happens in smaller presses is for free. So you had to count in, which is, you know, real expenses, what you really would pay yourself, what you really did. You would have paid a typesetter, and you would have paid, if you paid full wages and the wages they deserve. But you make this up in a sort of construct. It isn't what really happens in a small press, because a lot of people give a lot of time for free. And a lot of people give a lot of things, not just in match, but just for free and for outrageously low terms. And so I got tired of the fiction of it in some kind of way. I also got tired of the way we were being encouraged to even create a larger kind of structure that you would know as soon as we wouldn't get any funding, we'd have to fire everybody. I didn't want to play that game. I couldn't imagine hiring somebody as a junior editor, and no matter how that might improve the press in a certain kind of way, it would also lose what it's really about. It's about, to me, it was always about the founder and the view that I had. And I suppose that's kind of backwards. You know, I know that you're encouraged to say, what's the next generation going to think and how are they going to perceive it? But I really think any press, if it's small, is about the thinking of that person who's created it. And after that, it should die. It's a vision for a period of time. And I don't care how much you build it up or structure it, it shouldn't be thrown upon somebody else. Let them come up with a new vision. Sure, it would be nice to be able to pass on some of that wisdom and pass on some of that experience, but you're never going to be able to successfully do it because the other person's going to want to do it differently.
Right. And so, what you're saying is that, you know, in effect, that your publishing is your art. And yes. that the art stops when you stop.
Exactly. I another thing I learned over the years, I used to be kind of resentful because everybody would want to talk to me as a publisher, but never talk about my own writing. Then I finally realized, no, what they don't understand is that my publishing is no different from my writing.
Right.
It's all one big activity. And they just confused it and narrowed it down to one aspect. I can't talk in some ways, as you've already seen in this conversation, about my publishing without somehow, and I'm trying not to, but somehow getting into my writing as well, because for me, it's an art, just as you said. It's an activity of art. And I can't imagine giving that, passing on that to somebody else. They have to want to do that and find a way to do it as their own art. Otherwise, it's a business.
Right.
And I'm not a good business person. I can prove that. I've never had a salary. I've never made any money. I've just worked. It's hard to believe with all the books I've done, but I've worked book to book to book. And then sometimes I've done it. I don't even know how I did it. I found money when I didn't even have it. But I literally have worked from book to book. I haven't ever had a business, even when I tried to do business plans, and I can create them, I can imagine them, but it's never a concept that I have because it isn't a business. It's an art. It's an activity that was out of total commitment to writers and writing and the literature. I guess the total commitment is to literature, and the writer is just one aspect of that. And it was an educational activity and never a business activity.
Right, and I think in many ways I would put you as closest to Jargon Society and Jonathan Williams in that way, although your output is massively greater than Jonathan's, who, you know, but I think you have the same heart and kind of, the sort of irony of creating an institution while being an anti-institutionalist in order to maintain your integrity as an artist.
And you could also compare us, I think, and we have often been, Sun and Moon, not Green Integer so much, but Sun and Moon has often been compared to a kind of newer and younger, new directions. The only big difference is being I didn't inherit any money.
Right. Although I would resist that comparison directly because New Directions still exists long after James Laughlin has passed.
And it's still doing wonderful publishing, by the way.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I do not at all think that New Directions is a gone press. In fact, it may be more interesting.
That's why I'd say what you are and what your vision of publishing is, in fact, is completely different from New Directions.
Well, in terms of the continuation of it, yes. Although Jay Laughlin had debated whether it should go on,
right,
and gave them a certain period of years. If they could make it, fine. If they didn't, the funding wasn't going to continue. And I think they've. You know, it's been very hard for them, but I think they have, because they had this wonderful backlist, too.
Right, that's true. And I think in that way, City Lights and New Directions and Grove Press probably are more of a piece, you know, either more, though Grove is way more commercial. But
I think you
are more on the side of Jargon and Totem Press, you know, people like that, and who for whom the publishing is really, it is the art. And it's a singular vision, and it's one that deserves to, you know, maybe you've given it more attention than almost any other person could do single-handedly.
And sometimes it's worn me down, but otherwise it's also exhilarated me. It's also helped me understand my own role in writing and other things. It's helped to solidify that whole thing. I've been lucky. In a way, I never would have imagined this for myself, but I've been lucky to play that role. And also, I have to pause for a moment and simply say I couldn't have played that role without having a companion who was able to support me for all those years. I mean, I say I didn't inherit any money, but I did have Howard, you know, continuing to say, go ahead, do it. You know, and I still had a house to sleep in and food to eat on the table, and still do to this day. And so, I am blessed with that kind of gift. If I'd had to work, you know, when I started, I was a full-time professor running between two cities and still running the press. I wouldn't have been able to continue to do that, and still I wouldn't be here if I had continued to do that. I'd be dead by this point. I would have just worn out myself. You know?
Right. What you have had is a private grant from Howard. And in a way, you're again in a great tradition of arts patrons. You know, maybe Howard didn't imagine he was going to be that when he first
started. And you know, sometimes it's... understandably a bit resentful for having played that role for all those years. But nonetheless, we've both been lucky in that sense, and we've been lucky to be able to, you know, sustain the relationship and sustain the activities at the same time.
Right, which is wonderful. Well, listen, Doug, this is a perfect point for us to end this interview. I think we'll do another talk, as we've talked about, where we focus more on your writing, and then the publishing would be in the background. But I think this has been terrific, and I really appreciate your taking the time.
Well, this has been great, and I love talking to you.
Me as well. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Doug Messerly, founder, editor, designer, everything for Sun and Moon, Labah, and Green Integer.